Thanks for being here. I want to be upfront about what this conversation is and what it isn't. It's not a pitch. It's a practical conversation for program directors and academic leaders who are genuinely weighing whether CRN curriculum belongs in their institution, what it does, how it fits, and whether it's worth the integration work. If it's not the right fit, we'd rather know that early.
I appreciate that framing because the pressure we're feeling isn't abstract. Our students are graduating into ministry, chaplaincy, and pastoral care roles, and they are walking straight into mental health crises, grief responses, trauma disclosures, situations that require more than good intentions. We're not training therapists, and we know that. But right now, the gap between what we're giving students and what they're actually encountering in the field is real, and it's wide.
That gap is exactly where this conversation starts. And I think what makes it worth having is that we're operating from the same premise. Your graduates are going to be in the room when someone is struggling, whether you prepare them for it or not. The question isn't whether to address it. It's how to do it responsibly, within the scope of what a non-clinical program can and should do.
Right. And that's the tension our curriculum committee keeps coming back to. We don't want to overpromise to students or to the communities they'll serve. But doing nothing isn't a neutral choice either. So we're here to figure out whether CRN offers a responsible path forward, one that actually holds up when you put it in front of an accreditor or a field supervisor.
So let's talk about what a student actually walks away with. At the completion of CRN curriculum, a learner can do three things with reasonable consistency. They can recognize signs of psychological distress, acute crisis, grief responses, trauma indicators, without needing a clinical diagnosis to do it. They can respond in a way that stabilizes the moment and communicates genuine care. And they can refer, meaning they know how to connect someone to appropriate professional support, and they can do it without making the person feel dismissed or handed off. Recognize, respond, refer. That's the core competency framework.
That's a clean framework, but my curriculum committee is going to push on measurable. How do you actually assess whether a student can do those three things? Because recognize signs of distress could mean almost anything depending on how you assess it.
Fair push. The assessments are scenario-based. Students work through realistic pastoral and chaplaincy situations and demonstrate specific decision points. Can they identify the indicators present? Do they know what not to do, which is often more important than what to do? Can they articulate a referral pathway rather than just say, "I'd get them help"? The rubrics are tied to observable behaviors, not self-reported confidence.
Okay, that's more concrete. What about transfer? Because we've all seen students who perform well on a scenario in a classroom and then freeze in an actual field placement. How does the curriculum account for that gap?
We can't close that gap entirely. No curriculum can. What we can tell you is that the design is field-informed. The scenarios, the language, the case structures, they were built in consultation with chaplains, pastoral counselors, and community care practitioners who named the actual situations their students were encountering and struggling with. That's not the same as a randomized controlled trial, and I won't pretend it is, but it means the curriculum isn't built in the abstract. It reflects what practitioners tell us students need to be ready for.
I appreciate you naming that distinction. We've seen vendors oversell outcomes with research that doesn't hold up. What about learner populations? We have MDiv students who are going into full-time ministry, but we also have continuing education cohorts, lay leaders, deacons, community volunteers. Does this curriculum hold up across that range?
It does, and that's intentional. The curriculum is tiered and accessible. It doesn't require a clinical background or graduate-level training to engage with meaningfully. A lay leader completing a foundational module and an MDiv student completing an advanced integration module are working toward the same core competencies, but the depth and complexity of application scales. What we've heard consistently from field supervisors is that even the foundational tier moves learners from reactive to intentional. They stop improvising and start working from a framework.
That's actually where a lot of our field supervisors push back on our current curriculum. Students are caring, but they're improvising, which creates liability exposure and inconsistent outcomes. If CRN gives students a framework they can actually hold on to under pressure, that addresses a real problem for us. Let's get into the adoption mechanics, because that's where these conversations usually stall for us. The framework sounds right, the competencies make sense, but I have to go back to a curriculum committee, and they're going to ask, where does this actually live in our degree architecture? Does it count toward anything, or does it sit on top of everything we already require?
That's the right question to start with, and the honest answer is, it depends on how your program maps competencies. But CRN is designed to slot in, not to sit on top. Most programs we work with integrate CRN curriculum into existing pastoral care sequences, field education preparation, or chaplaincy practicum prerequisites. It's modular enough that it can fill a gap in an existing course, stand as a discrete elective, or anchor a continuing education certificate, depending on what your architecture needs.
What about clinical pastoral education alignment? Some of our students are heading toward CPE accreditation, and our CPE supervisor is very specific about what counts toward competency documentation. Can CRN curriculum speak to those frameworks, or does it exist in a parallel universe?
CRN doesn't claim to substitute for CPE hours. That would be overclaiming, and it would also be wrong. What it does do is speak the same competency language. The Recognize, Respond, Refer framework maps cleanly onto care competency domains that CPE supervisors are already assessing. Things like identifying pastoral care needs, demonstrating appropriate boundaries, and facilitating access to other support systems. We can provide a competency crosswalk document that shows your CPE supervisor exactly where CRN outcomes intersect with their frameworks. That's not a substitution argument. It's a preparation argument. Students who complete CRN curriculum arrive at CPE more ready.
A competency crosswalk is actually useful. Our CPE supervisor would engage with that. But let me push on the white label piece, because I've seen white label mean very different things from different vendors. What does it actually mean here? Are we getting syllabi we can modify? Or are we licensing a locked course and putting our logo on it?
It means you get curriculum infrastructure that you can make yours. Syllabi, learning objectives, scenario sets, and assessments that you can adapt to your institutional voice, your program context, and your students. Branding is straightforward. Your institution's name and identity on the materials. But beyond that, you're also getting instructor support, facilitation guides, discussion frameworks, and access to our team for onboarding and ongoing questions. The core content and the guardrails stay intact because those are what make it defensible. But the framing, the application context, the way it integrates into your existing course, that's yours to shape.
That distinction between what's fixed and what's adaptable matters a lot for our faculty. They're not going to hand off their courses to an outside curriculum and disappear. They need to be able to teach it as their own. What exactly stays fixed?
Three things stay fixed: the refer not treat boundary, the multi-faith neutral framing, and the evidence honest standard. Meaning we don't make clinical claims the curriculum can't support, and neither do you when you're delivering it. Those aren't arbitrary restrictions. They're the design decisions that keep the curriculum in scope for non-clinical programs and protect your institution from liability exposure. Everything else, how you sequence it, how you contextualize the scenarios, how you assess it in relation to your program outcomes, that's where your faculty bring their expertise.
The refer not treat piece is actually something I want to spend a minute on, because I can imagine our accreditor asking about it both ways. On one hand, it keeps us out of clinical scope. That's good. On the other hand, could they see it as a limitation? Like, are we training students to recognize problems and then not fully equip them to help?
That's the right accreditation question. And here's how I'd frame the answer. Refer not treat isn't a gap in the training. It's the correct scope for a non-clinical program. Accreditors who oversee ministry and chaplaincy programs understand that pastoral caregivers are not licensed clinicians, and training them to stay within appropriate boundaries is a feature, not a deficiency. What CRN does is make that boundary explicit, train students to hold it under pressure, and equip them with the referral skills to actually be useful when they reach it. An accreditor reviewing this curriculum sees a program that understands scope of practice. That's a credibility signal, not a weakness.
Okay, I can work with that framing. Now, the multi-faith neutrality. We are a confessional seminary. We have a theological identity, and our faculty are going to have questions about a curriculum that doesn't engage that identity. How does this work in a context where we're explicitly forming students within a tradition?
This is one of the most common questions we get from seminary partners, and it's a fair one. multi-faith neutrality in CRN curriculum means the content doesn't privilege or impose any particular spiritual framework. It doesn't assume a theological lens that would exclude students from other traditions, and it doesn't require students to bracket their own tradition to engage with the material. What it doesn't mean is that your institution has to be religiously neutral. Your faculty can and should situate the curriculum within your theological framework in how they teach it. CRN gives them the mental health and crisis competency layer. Your tradition gives it pastoral meaning.
That's a more nuanced answer than I expected. So the curriculum itself is the neutral infrastructure, and the theological formation sits around it. Not inside it, but not in conflict with it either.
Exactly. And for institutions that serve diverse student bodies or operate in interfaith chaplaincy contexts, that neutrality is a direct asset. They don't have to build a separate version for students from different backgrounds. For confessional institutions, it's a layer that your tradition wraps around. Either way, the competency outcomes are the same. The pathway to those outcomes just looks different, depending on how your faculty contextualize the material.
That actually addresses something our interfaith certificate program director raised separately. They've been looking for mental health literacy content that doesn't assume a Christian framework. If this curriculum can work for our MDiv students and our interfaith certificate students without being rebuilt from scratch, that's a meaningful efficiency for us.
That's exactly the integration efficiency the design is meant to create. One curriculum infrastructure, multiple deployment contexts. Your MDiv students, your interfaith certificate cohort, your continuing education lay leaders, same core competency framework, contextualized by your faculty for each setting. That's what keeps the licensing relationship practical, rather than requiring a custom build every time your program needs expand. I want to step back for a moment and talk about the guardrails as a whole, not just how they fit accreditation, but why they exist as design decisions in the first place. Refer not treat, multi-faith neutral, evidence honest, accessible. Those four aren't constraints we added to make the curriculum safer to sell. They're the architecture. They're what makes the curriculum honest about what it is and deployable across very different institutional contexts.
Let's test that, because it's a feature, not a bug, is something vendors say a lot. Walk me through a real scenario. A student completes this curriculum, they're in a field placement, and the person they're sitting with starts disclosing something that feels clinical, suicidal ideation, a trauma history that's clearly destabilizing. What does CRN trained actually mean in that moment? Does the curriculum leave them with anything useful, or does the refer not treat guardrail just mean they've been trained to say, that's not my lane?
That's the right scenario to pressure test this with, and the honest answer is, CRN trained means that student doesn't freeze and they don't overcorrect. They've practiced exactly that moment. They know how to stay present without escalating into amateur clinical territory, how to acknowledge what's being shared, how to communicate that the person's experience is being taken seriously, and how to move toward a referral in a way that doesn't feel like abandonment. The refer not treat guardrail isn't step back and do nothing. It's a trained response with a specific skill set behind it.
Okay, but what about the student who decides in that moment that they can do more? We've had students in clinical pastoral education who overreach. They think they can handle something they're not equipped for, and it creates real harm. Does the curriculum build in anything that actually holds that boundary under pressure, or is it aspirational?
It builds it in explicitly, and that's where the evidence-honest guardrail connects. Part of what students learn is why the boundary exists, not just that it exists. They work through scenarios where overreach produces worse outcomes, not better ones. They learn that a person in crisis is not well served by a pastoral caregiver who improvises therapy. That understanding is what makes the boundary durable under pressure. It's not just a rule. It's a framework the student can articulate and defend to themselves, to the person they're caring for.
That's a more substantive answer than I expected. Now, the evidence-honest standard. What does that mean in practice when your facilitators are teaching this? Because some of our faculty are going to want to point to research, and if the curriculum can't support strong evidentiary claims, that's going to create friction.
Evidence-honest means we don't dress up practitioner-informed design as clinical research. The curriculum doesn't cite efficacy studies that don't exist. What it does is reflect what skilled practitioners in pastoral care, chaplaincy, and community mental health tell us works. The frameworks, the language, the decision points. Your faculty can teach it as field-informed best practice, because that's what it is. That's an honest claim. What they can't do, and what the curriculum won't support, is presenting it as evidence-based intervention with outcome data behind it. The integrity of that distinction is actually what protects your institution.
And the accessible piece. Is that about reading level and format? Or is there something more structural there?
Both. Accessible means the curriculum doesn't require a clinical vocabulary or a graduate-level baseline to engage with meaningfully. A lay deacon and an MDiv student can both work through foundational content and come away with a usable framework. The depth scales, but the core competencies don't get locked behind prerequisite knowledge. That's a structural choice that also serves your institution practically. You're not managing two separate curriculum tracks for two different learner populations. The same infrastructure stretches.
What I'm hearing across all four of those guardrails is that they're not just protecting students, they're protecting us as the institution. The liability exposure from a student who overreaches clinically, the credibility exposure from overstating research, the operational burden of running separate tracks for different populations. The guardrails address institutional risk, not just learner risk.
That's exactly right, and it's worth naming directly. CRN isn't therapy training, and it's not designed to produce anything close to a clinical credential. What it produces is a learner who knows their role, knows its limits, and has practiced both. That clarity about what this is and what it isn't is what makes it deployable across a confessional seminary, an interfaith chaplaincy program, and a continuing education cohort for lay leaders without requiring a different version of the curriculum for each one. The guardrails are the consistency mechanism. They're what makes the whole thing hold. So let me be concrete about the value case, because we've covered a lot of ground, and I want to land it clearly. What institutions gain from a licensing relationship with CRN is curriculum infrastructure you don't have to build from scratch. Scenario sets, assessments, facilitation guides, competency frameworks that are already field-tested. You get reduced build time, which for most program directors means the difference between getting something into a curriculum cycle this year or pushing it 2 years out. You get learner readiness that your field supervisors will notice, students who arrive at placements with a framework rather than good intentions. And you get field credibility, because the curriculum reflects what practitioners actually named as the gaps. That's the value. It's not a credential your institution earns by licensing it. It's infrastructure that makes your program stronger, faster.
I want to name what actually moved the needle for me in this conversation, because it wasn't the feature list. It was two things. The operational honesty about what CRN is and isn't. You didn't oversell outcomes. You didn't pretend the evidence base is something it's not. And the fact that the guardrails are actually designed for institutions like ours, not just tolerated by them. That's a different posture than most curriculum vendors take, and it matters when I'm the one who has to stand in front of a curriculum committee and defend the decision.
That's the relationship we're trying to build. One where you can defend the decision because the decision is defensible. The first step is straightforward. Reach out, tell us about your program architecture and your learner populations, and we'll show you specifically how integration could work for your context. No generic pitch, a real conversation about fit. If it's there, we'll build from it. If it's not, you'll know that quickly too.
And for program directors listening to this, who are in the same position we started in, students heading into the field underprepared for what they're going to encounter, this is worth the conversation. The gap is real. The question is whether you close it with something that holds up, or you keep hoping good formation is enough on its own.
Your graduates are going to be in the room when someone is struggling. Equip them to be there well. Start the conversation.